KPCW News time is 8:06. As I mentioned in the Lost and Found report a few minutes ago, we have lost power here on Main Street. We are operating on a generator. Let me tell you a little bit about what we know about the power outage. Approximately 1,348 customers are affected. First, this began around 7:30 this morning. The cause, Rocky Mountain Power tells us, is enhanced safety settings. These are used to prevent wildfires from starting. When they are in place, these enhanced safety settings apparently increase the potential for outages. And unfortunately, Rocky Mountain Power says we may experience longer than typical outages as field crews work to patrol the lines before restoring power. If you want the latest information on the outage, visit rockymountainpower.net/outages. I have to wonder if it's going to affect the continuing setup for the Arts Fest over on Main Street, whether it's going to affect their ability to access power tools and other things. But that's what's going on with respect to the power outage. If I get more information during the course of this broadcast, we will certainly update you. Coming up, I will be speaking with Chris Finney about the various road closures and other transportation options associated with the Kimball Arts Festival. Then Professor Phil Allen will discuss the use of wildflowers for fire mitigation. And we're going to finish our hour by speaking with filmmaker Nim Shapira and Park City local Harry Cantor about the film Torn, which was screened on August 11th here in Park City. Please stay tuned. The Summer Bike Patrol and Trail Crew at Park City Mountain have filed a petition to unionize. The Bike Patrol and Trail Crew are two summer operations at the resort that are largely composed of employees who are also ski patrollers during the winter, according to a press release. A majority of those employees are thus part of the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association, which ratified a new contract with Vail Resorts following the high-profile strike that occurred last winter during the holiday season. By petitioning for union representation, the Bike Patrol and Trail Crew are moving to become their own union. The group is represented by the Communications Workers of America Union, which also represents the Ski Patrol. The group wants to bring summer wages up to meet winter wages. We're aware of the petition filed by Bike Patrols and Trail Crew at Park City Mountain, a resort spokesman said in a statement. We believe a direct connection to our employees fosters the strongest working relationship between our employees and their resort leaders, but we respect their right to file this petition and are engaging in this process. The summertime employees seeking to unionize are required to have medical certificates and are asked to participate in lift evacuation exercises and many other skilled and dangerous jobs. A High Valley Transit passenger hit by a car 2 years ago claims a bus stop on Kilby Road is dangerous. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the passenger has sued, told the county and bus agency responsible.
In a lawsuit filed Wednesday, Luana Aparecida Vera Santana says a car struck her in the crosswalk on Kilby Road near the Powderwood Condos bus stop 2 years ago. Santana, who's from Santa Catarina, Brazil, had disembarked from a westbound bus August 3, 2023, and claims she was walking in the crosswalk shortly after 10 p.m. when an eastbound SUV struck her. The lawsuit claims Santana fractured her skull, nose, and ankle, sustained a brain injury, and is permanently impaired as a result. The driver of the 1998 Dodge Durango, who told sheriff's deputies they didn't see Santana, was not charged. A sheriff's office accident report says the case was not referred to county prosecutors because the driver remained on the scene to assist and did not appear intoxicated. Deputies also say lighting and heavy rain conditions likely contributed to the incident. Santana is not suing the driver, but instead Summit County and High Valley Transit. The lawsuit alleges the crosswalk Santana used from the westbound bus stop to the other side of the road is unsafe because of the lack of lighting signals or signs in advance. A photo included in court papers shows there was a sign present at the crosswalk itself when Santana was hit, but the lawsuit says it's also difficult for eastbound traffic to see because it's on the other side of a small hill. Santana's attorneys did not return a request for comment Thursday. Summit County declined to comment. In an email, High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez told KPCW the agency is aware of the incident and said our thoughts are with the individual and their family during this difficult time. She wrote, while we cannot comment on the specifics of pending litigation, we can confirm the complaint appears to focus solely on any public entity with jurisdiction, which may reflect insurance considerations rather than questions of fault. Since the incident, bus routes along Kilby Road have changed. There are now a handful of new westbound stops that also require passengers to cross Kilby Road to reach apartments, condominiums, or Quarry Village. Some don't have crosswalks. Rodriguez further said safety is High Valley Transit's highest priority and that the agency is committed to working with all parties to ensure a full understanding of what occurred. Summit County and High Valley Transit are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Park City voters can learn more about the candidates running for mayor and city council at an upcoming event. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has the details.
The Wasatch Back chapter of the League of Women Voters and the Proactive Alliance are co-hosting a Meet the Candidates event at the Park City Library Monday evening. Monica Schaefer with the League of Women Voters said the forum will run from 7:30 to 9 p.m. in the library's community room on the third floor. Schaefer said all eight city council candidates and the two mayoral candidates have been asked to speak.
We just invite them to just say in their own words, you know, what are your passions, what are your visions, what differentiates you from the other candidates. And after that, we'd like to just invite the public to engage one-on-one with each candidate on a just very casual individual basis.
She said candidates will speak in a random order and there will be no moderated questions. Four of the eight city council candidates will advance following the August 12th primary election. There is no primary for the mayor's race as there are only two candidates. Schaefer relaunched the Wasatch Back chapter of the League of Women Voters this year after it folded during the COVID-19 pandemic. The group has monthly meetings at her home in Pine Brook. The Proactive Alliance, which is co-sponsoring Monday's candidate event, was also started this year, according to organizer Ann Curvin.
It was the result of sort of a negative dialogue that was happening here and everywhere, and we wanted to sort of change that dialogue. We wanted to provide an opportunity for people to come together and talk about what's going on and take positive action.
The organization holds a monthly speaker series on the first Wednesday of every month. The Proactive Alliance and the League of Women Voters are also co-hosting a suffragette party at Rotary Park on August 18th to honor the 105th anniversary of women's right to vote in the United States. More information about both organizations and their upcoming events can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, last night after dinner, my family and I went out for an ice cream cone on Main Street. And it looked like a typical summer evening. People were walking around. But overnight, something pretty spectacular has happened. And as I drove into the station today and looked to my right over at Main Street, it had been transformed. The 56th annual Kimball Arts Festival is here in town. It's going to feature over 200 artists specializing in 13 different mediums. Here's to understand the bit of the logistics is Park City Special Events Manager Chris Finney. Morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So last night it looked pretty normal. When did things start to change? About what time?
Yeah, Kimball started moving in this morning at 3 a.m.
I assume you were here.
I was not here, actually. Okay. The great Park City Patrol officers were here this morning to help clear the street and help the Kimball folks start moving onto the street.
So they move onto the street around 3, and they have to be set up completely by what time do things start tonight?
The festival opens at 5 p.m., so it's definitely a push.
And there's still a lot of movement over there. So obviously they shut down Main Street. How far from where to where? The entire Main Street?
That's correct. From the top of Main Street, where Swede on the south end, all the way down to 9th Street will be shut down, including Heber Avenue and 7th Avenue.
Okay, so obviously there's significant traffic issues for tonight. Let's talk about, what are the other road charges? Is Swede Alley also closed?
Swede Alley is closed as well. It's all back-of-house operations. We do have some residential permits for all the residents who live on Swede Alley, as well as the businesses that have off-street parking.
Okay, so I want to come to the festival tonight. How do I get here?
I would say the best way to go is our awesome free transit. I would park at the resort, the high school, or out at Richardson Flat and take the bus in. There's definitely a bus lane on Deer Valley Drive, so traffic will be a little slower because of that, but the transit will be running quickly right up the bus lane.
Okay, so let's talk about those three options. Richardson Flat, how often do we expect buses to be running from Richardson Flat? And at what hours will those be available?
Sure, it's a 10-minute frequency all day. So today being the first, extra service from 10 minutes service will be 4 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. from Richardson Flat.
And coming back the other way, math tells me that it'll be 10 minutes going the other way, too.
That's correct. There'll be several buses running in those.
And again, going back out, I would catch it in the transit center here at the foot of Main Street.
That's
correct. Okay, so that's Richardson Flat. Let's do this all three. High school, also 10 minutes?
Yep. Same, everything.
Is it the same bus? Does the Richardson Flat?
Oh, no, it's different buses.
Okay, and then resort. Yeah, 10 minutes. Same bus or different buses?
Different buses.
Wow. Okay. My favorite thing to go to get to Park City Market is the bicycle check. Is that going to be available?
Yep. They're going to have a bike valet on 7th Street, just the same spot they usually do.
And just to make sure we catch the other issue that people are always concerned about is, it's one thing to get there. How do I get back? How late will the buses run back to those three remote locations?
It'll be 9:30 p.m. to Richardson Flat, and then later around midnight for Park City Mont Resort and the high school.
So the key is, if you want to go out for a drink after the Arts Fest, don't park at Richardson Flat.
Right.
You're better off parking at one of the other two locations. Okay. Some people just insist on going in their cars. Traffic is going to be really difficult. Will there be public parking at all available at China Bridge?
Yes. China Bridge will be open with special event rates. So that's $9 an hour, max of $40.
And that's going to be true all weekend?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay, and I'm looking at your information sheet. There are private parking lots available. I don't know where those are. Oh, like, the standard ones, like the one at the foot of Deer Valley. I'm sorry, at the foot of Main Street, there is a private lot there, yeah?
That's correct. So there's a Diamond lot.
Diamond,
right down there on the bottom of Main Street, as well as Marriott Summit Watch.
And, of course, the other option that people like to talk about is Ubers and taxis. How will those work?
That's correct. So whether you're driving yourself or Uber or Lyft, our drop-and-load area is on the south end of Marsac, so the parking lot on the south side of the Marsac building. There'll be a roundabout set up there so we can drop off or pick up right there. So all of the hotel shuttles and Uber and Lyfts have been notified that that's the drop-in.
And that's up here on the roof of the China Bridge lot?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, that's been used before for that reason. Yeah.
Correct. Every Sunday for Park City, it's the same.
All right. Anything else we haven't touched on in terms of parking, transit, and accessibility?
I think we've hit most of it. I guess I would just add that the festival runs today from 5 to 9, Saturday from 10 to 8, and Sunday from 10 to 6.
And tonight is the Summit County Locals night, as I understand.
That's
How does
correct.
That work?
So if you go on to the Kimball Arts Festival website and search the ticket tab, you can register as a local. So anyone from Summit County can enter their zip code as their password, and they'll be registered and get free admission to the festival.
Okay. All right. So, Chris, this is an enormous undertaking. I mean, as I was driving in today, I can see all these volunteers with their vests. Talk to us a little bit about, from the city's perspective, when do you start planning for this, and how complicated is it?
So we start planning for this in March. We go to council usually with their supplemental plan mid-April, and then we have weekly and biweekly meetings with the Kimball team and my staff, as well as the Park City Police Department, Transit, Parking. And it's a big undertaking for sure.
Now, does this end up costing the city money, or does Kimball, or are there other fees that come back to the city to compensate for all that effort?
It's definitely tax revenue that comes back to the city. Mm-hmm. The Kimball has a service contract with the city, so we have a number of fees that we will waive for the festival.
To waive for it, because do we have any sense as to what the impact of the festival is, the economic impact of the festival is on the city in terms of things like restaurant revenues and other kinds of sort of benefits the city gets from having all these people in town?
We come back with a debrief in October, so I don't have those numbers with me. But
you do that every year, right?
Yeah, every year we come back with the debrief. So we have the supplemental plan that gets approved in April, and then we'll come back to council in October.
So Chris, this is obviously one of the larger special events of the year. What's the next one that you're starting to work on, and which which of these is the most difficult for you? I like that. I like that response.
You know, I think our team does a great job city-wise. I don't know which one would be the most difficult. Our next one in 2 weeks, we'll be doing the Park City Song Summit, which is down in City Park.
And that's the first time it's come into the city, isn't it?
They've been into the city and on smaller venues on Main Street. They've taken over some of the Main Street venues here. It'll be the first time in the city for this large of an event.
And so they'll be in City Park for several nights?
Correct. So August 15th and 16th, they'll be down at City Park, as well as the 14th, 15th, and 16th at the library.
And now that doesn't have, does that have road closure implications too, or is it just simply just a big event here in town?
Just a big event in town. We'll have different routes that some of their shuttles will be driving, where their Ubers and Lyfts and hotel shuttles will drop off. But no road closures.
And then what about Miner's Day? To what extent is that a...
And then next up would be Miner's Day, correct. Mm-hmm. So that's Labor Day here in town. We'll be having a parade, normal big parade like the 4th of July, and then activities down in South End City Park.
And of course, the difference between the July 4th and the Miner's Day parade is that we get stuck with politicians on the Miner's Day parade. It's a long-standing tradition here in Park City that the politicians show up, and given that this is a contentious election year, I would expect to see quite a few of them.
I would agree with you.
Okay, that takes us to Miner's Day. Is there anything else before the winter comes?
We do, there's definitely the Shot Ski in October.
Oh, the Shot Ski,
there's
yes.
also Halloween on Main Street. And also, you know, we continue with the Deer Valley concerts, concerts in the park with Mountain Town Music, as well as on in Miners Park.
Okay. Chris, anything else you want to touch on before we get out of here?
I would just say, as usual, with these big events coming in the town, I would take transit. I'd park at a satellite location and just, you know, get in that Park City mindset of just getting in the chill mode and being patient, taking your time, getting in and out, and coming and have fun. Should be a great event.
Well, the other thing I have to say is, having gone to this Friday night opening of the Summit Arts Festival for many, many years, it's a good chance to see lots of people you haven't seen for a while, because everybody's here on Friday night. It is truly a locals' night extravaganza.
It is a great time to see your friends you may not have seen in a bit. There is a Spirit Garden with music and other activities and food on Heber Ave. I'd stop by there, and you probably have a good chance of seeing someone you know.
All right, Chris, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Great, thank you.
In Wasatch County, residents must seek out their own recycling services. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports that Midway could become the first local government to change that.
Without recycling as the default for Wasatch County households, residents need to figure out their own solutions if they want to divert plastic, glass, and more from the landfill. Some people drive their items north to Park City's Recycle Utah facility. Others pay monthly fees for private curbside pickup services. Still, only about 20% of Wasatch County homes regularly recycle. That's according to Ryan Smith, the CEO of Recyclops. He founded the company over a decade ago to make recycling accessible to Utahns and residents in nearly a dozen other states. Smith is now talking with Midway leaders about the city becoming the first place in Wasatch County to offer recycling for every home. Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson says she's wanted to pursue curbside recycling for her citizens for years. If city leaders agree it's a good idea, Midway would try an opt-out program through Recyclops. A vote could happen as soon as August.
It makes the monthly fee dramatically less than what is currently being offered. This is something that many members of our community have been asking for, and we will sign up for a one-year trial, and hopefully it will be well received.
She emphasized recycling is just a proposal at this point. No final decisions have been made. Johnson says the more residents who participate, the lower the cost. With the citywide program, the monthly fee per household would be around $17, compared to the $29 Wasatch County residents currently pay. This would be the first opt-out venture for Recyclops. It has partnerships with the Vernal and Nephi city governments, but locals still must register for those programs. Johnson says she's always been interested in recycling and made it a priority after Salt Lake City gave its recycling facility a major upgrade. Smith says he wants to make it convenient for Midway residents to recycle.
You got to start somewhere, right? And we feel like Midway is the optimal place to get started and have confidence that it could be quite successful.
He says he's excited for the possibility of expanding recycling access in Wasatch County.
I feel really strongly that we don't want to force anyone to do anything. But what we are interested in is increasing participation and making sure that people who are interested but, you know, haven't gotten around to signing up or didn't know about it, or that those people have, you know, the convenience of it just being there for them.
Johnson says council members will determine if Midway is ready for a citywide recycling program when she shares the proposal with the city council in a few weeks. She says she's tried to address some of the most common local concerns. Johnson says staff will make it simple for people to call the city to opt out, and recycling will be collected by SUVs with trailers rather than large, noisy trucks. As Johnson nears the end of her time as mayor, she says she wants to leave a legacy of care for the environment.
For me, my most passionate thing was just getting an open space bond on the ballot. And to have that happen twice and pass twice is something that I am incredibly happy about. It really is about protecting our agricultural community and making sure that we have positioned ourselves so that if there ever came a time when we had to support ourselves with our own food, we could do that.
Midway voters overwhelmingly supported a $5 million open space bond during the November 2024 election and another $5 million bond 6 years before that. Johnson says she would love to see Midway offer yard waste pickup along with convenient recycling. The Midway City Council will discuss whether to move forward with curbside recycling at its meeting August 19th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Wildfires continue to be a major challenge here in the Wasatch. Our guest this morning does not advocate for fighting fire with fire. Rather, he believes in fighting fire with wildflowers. Phil Allen is a plant and wildlife sciences professor at BYU. Good morning and welcome to the broadcast.
Good morning, Roger.
Okay, Phil, tell us a little bit about your background and the nature of your work at BYU.
Yes, I have a PhD in horticulture from the University of Minnesota. But long before that, I grew up mostly in the Uinta Mountain Range of Utah and fell in love with native plants. So when I came to BYU, I had the opportunity of developing a research program, and we initially began by studying beautiful wildflowers of Utah. We quickly discovered that our natural areas were being overrun with invasive annual weeds for the most part, like cheatgrass. And while timber burns up high in the mountains at higher elevations, cheatgrass is all around our foothills, our rangelands, and so forth. So we decided we had to understand cheatgrass, while at the same time, I was continued the passion of wildflowers and have returned to that by working to restore the mouth of Rock Canyon in Provo.
Cheatgrass is it sounds like nasty stuff. Is it an indigenous species, or did it come from somewhere else?
Cheatgrass came from Eurasia, initially in wheat shipments, and the farmers that planted the wheat called it cheatgrass because they didn't know what it was, but it cheated them out of some of their harvest. So it spread following disturbance, mining, grazing, other kinds of construction related to urban areas, and it's now the dominant plant in Utah and all the states that surround it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do we find it throughout the Mountain West, or is it mostly here in Utah?
It's throughout the Mountain West, especially at foothill elevations, and then out in the West Desert and areas south of Tooele. You know, goes for 100, 150 miles.
And, you know, we mentioned earlier, one of the problem with cheatgrass is where it sits. I take it is not only an invasive species that chokes out other plants, but it also is a real fire hazard. Does it just ignite easily? Is that the problem?
It ignites easily. I think I mentioned that it matures in June, and it's ready to burn. Mm. We have actually counted up to 35,000 seeds per square yard of cheatgrass. And hundreds of plants. So it's very, very dense, like a carpet, and it provides fuel. If it's ignited, then and there's any wind at all, it just moves very, very rapidly.
Now, how do wildflowers
start?
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just going to say it can spread from the lower elevations into the dry timber above, and that's the risk with what we call forest fires.
And tell us a little bit about the kinds of projects you do. How do you sort of replace the cheatgrass with wildflowers, and what's the effect?
Right. Well, a lot of my publications, research-wise, which are you can see on my website, are about wildfire flowers, and the emphasis long-term has been on water conservation. Wildflower meadows require up to 75% to 90% less water, as we demonstrated in a 7-acre project that we completed in Heber. The way that they help with the wildfire issue is native plants are perennials. That means they live for longer than 1 year. So they're trying to stay alive, and they don't use all the water and suck it all out of the ground, but they partition that water use and stay greener longer. So, and they're a lot less dense. They're a lot less flammable.
Okay, so for a project like the one you guys did in Heber or the one in Rock Canyon, how do you find these projects, or do they find you?
Well, we were approached by Provo City in about 2000, and they had this trailhead park at the mouth of Rock Canyon, which is the most heavily used canyon along the Wasatch Front that does not have a road. Provo City has estimates that there are over 20,000 people a month visiting here. So they said, hey, we want a different kind of a park. We don't want to have Kentucky bluegrass and have to water it. Can you help us out? Long story short, the canyon has undergone a lot of positive changes. The private landowners were bought out, and a conservation easement was put into place that allows this area to be protected and conserved so that we can carry on our efforts here. The project in Heber was at the request of an individual who had been a friend of our program and department for a number of years after he moved from Ohio. We put that landscape in, and it was actually selected as an award-winning project, the only award-winning project by the National Association of Landscape Professionals that was completed entirely by students.
Okay. If listeners want to learn more about these projects, is there a website that they can go visit?
I would recommend two sources, at least for locally to the Wasatch Front. One is the Conserve Utah Valley, and the other one is the Rock Canyon Preservation Alliance. Both of those solicit a lot of help from volunteers. The agencies don't have the resources or funds to do it, but we're continuing to work very, very hard with really thousands of volunteers, and over the process of several years, we're going to make great headway as we have here at Rock Canyon.
We've been speaking with Professor Phil Allen, a plant and wildlife sciences professor at BYU. Our interview got interrupted, but fortunately we were able to finish. Professor Allen, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You're very welcome, Roger. Have a great day.
The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is helping Utahns in the Wasatch Back to be better equipped to handle youth mental health concerns. KPCW's Honus Wright has the details.
The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is offering a free class on youth mental health first aid Saturday, August 2nd. It will be taught entirely in Spanish. The class is for adults who regularly interact with youth. It will cover the signs and symptoms of suicidal ideation and how to respond to them. AFSP Spanish Language Programs Manager Sergio de Chazal says the curriculum comes from the National Council for Mental Well-Being. Though he is not mandated to teach the course as part of his job, he says he does it to help others share the life-saving information.
They tell me, you saved my life, and I'm like, no, I didn't save your life. But the reality is that, no, I'm not saving your life. You're saving your life. You're doing the things that you have to do in order to change your life.
He says the course will help people understand there are many ways to better their lives, including meditation, reading, writing, exercise, and getting the recommended amount of sleep. Saturday's free 8-hour class is from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Park City Library. No registration is required. Escucha esta historia en español en kpcw.org/en español. Jonas Wright, KPCW News.
Longtime Park City resident Dave Hanscom is nearly done with his 40 after 80 challenge. His goal? Climb 40 of the nation's high points after turning 80 and document one bird species in each of the 50 states. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Dave Hanscom says the pursuit began after he retired from the University of Utah in 2006, saying it was important to have goals after working for more than 40 years.
I turned 66 and I thought, you know, I should try to get to the high points of all the states. And so 50 high points, and how about 50 birds in every state too? So, you know, that's kind of round numbers.
Hanscom paused his ambitions for about 10 years to care for his wife, Mary, who passed away in 2023. since he was 10 years older at that point, and he had already completed some of the more difficult climbs in Wyoming, Montana, Washington, and California, and had already elected to drop Alaska's Mount McKinley from his list, he began to focus on the summits he thought would be doable.
At the end of last year, I thought, I need a new goal, because what I have left is easy. I woke up in the middle of the night last winter, and I thought, 40 after 80, that's kind of a nice round number. I'll bet you I can still do 40 high points after I turned 80. I already had all the ones in the middle of the country, so that meant I had to do some tougher ones. So that's what I'm in the process of doing now.
This year, he started in Texas and has made his way to New Mexico and most recently, Colorado.
New Mexico high point is 13,000 feet, and I wasn't sure how my 84-year-old body was going to respond to that high elevation, but I felt great. So I thought, I wonder if I could do Colorado again. That's 14,000. I wasn't planning to. So I did that, much to my, I don't know about surprise, but relief maybe. I just was really pleased and grateful, actually, to be there.
The challenge he set for himself, he says, has proved to be an incentive to keep going.
As you get older, it's always tempting to sit on the couch. And I love being outdoors. I love being on top of mountains. You know, every mountain's a gift these days. So I think, you know, that's really my incentive to keep moving.
Next month, Hanscom will travel back to New England to summit the peaks in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and New York. After that, he'll head to Nevada. He was on his way to hike Mount Mitchell in North Carolina last year when Hurricane Helene hit, destroying Blue Ridge Parkway State Park, which is still closed. He hopes the park can be reopened next year so he can finish the East Coast climbs. Although he's the co-author of three ski touring books, Hanscom says he has no plans to publish his 40 after 80 adventures. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Torn is a new documentary about how the Israel-Palestine conflict after October 7th led to a poster war on the streets of New York City. Joining us to discuss the film is director Nim Shapira and Park City local Harry Cantor, who is bringing the film here to Park City on August 11th. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Nim, how are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Nim, can you set the stage a bit, describing the posters that are at the center of the controversy and how they came to sort of be?
So if we go back to winter of 2023, October 7, 251 individuals from over 40 nationalities, Buddhists and Hindus and Christians and Muslims and Jews were kidnapped from their homes, from parties, into the Gaza Strip. And that's what started the war that happened and the ongoing catastrophe. And basically, the second they were kidnapped, people wanted to talk about the international humanitarian crisis. So two artists by the name of Nitzan and Dede created a poster per kidnapped person. So you ended up with 251 posters, and they started out in New York, and then you see them all over the world. Posters covering lampposts, trees, walls, everywhere from faith centers to religious centers to universities to just like private homes and offices. And it started out as a cry for help, a cry for the international community. But as soon as they were put up, they were torn down. And with that, the fabric of the city of New York, the social fabric, was torn down as well. And that is what my film documents.
And again, just for those who, I certainly remember the images of those posters. So the posters would have a photograph of the of one of the hostages. And what would it say on it in addition?
The posters were very minimal in copy and in the photo. It was the photo of the person, their age, name, and also it just said kidnapped on the top in red letters. And on the bottom, it said, please help us to bring them home.
Okay. And I take it that the impact, and we're going to get to the impact on the city and sort of the larger story, but is that what inspired you to make the film, sort of to try to capture the pain and the sort of controversy that surrounded those posters?
So I moved to New York 12 years ago, and I really felt since October 7, 2023, that the social fabric of the city was torn. And this is actually what prompted me to make this film. It was this urgency. You know, there are so many important documentaries and news reports, not about only about the hostages, but also about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I wanted to focus on America. I wanted to focus on freedom of speech. I wanted to focus on empathy. And I feel like, you know, the film covers the poster war between the pro-Israelis and pro-Palestinians, but it actually covers something much bigger. It covers how it's very hard to sit down and talk to someone that you disagree with. And I feel like this is something, again, as a New Yorker for the past 12 years, this is something that I personally was struggling with.
So help us understand. I remember when this was starting to go on and you'd see news reports of people tearing down posters. Why, in your view, did the posters become such a flashpoint for controversy?
So I think that, again, there are many, many reasons, and my film covers or aims to cover all of those reasons. I think there's a spectrum of why people rip down the posters. Some people, you know, they don't read the fine print and they see the poster as propaganda. They see the posters and they ask themselves, why do I see a poster that cry out for an Israeli person that was kidnapped, but I don't see posters that talk about the Palestinian victims? And other people, you know, so if I say some people are triggered by it and are just angry that this is covering the public space and something else doesn't, but some people see this as propaganda. I heard the conspiracy theories that these posters are by the Mossad, by the government of Israel. These posters are not a grassroots effort by my friends. So there's a lot of different reasons why posters are being ripped down. But at the bottom line, I would say that there is a lot of suffering, unfortunately, on both sides. There is a lot of suffering on the Palestinian side as well. And I think that in the first few weeks as Israel, but also the world was recovering from the October 7 massacres, people asked themselves, why is empathy a limited resource? And that's a question that both sides are asking. So I would say that's the root of the issue.
That's a really interesting point. Why is empathy a limited resource? What kinds of people were you able to talk to in an interview for the film? Were you able to get a fairly wide spectrum of views?
So I always, the screen has been in over 70 screenings all across the United States, from Miami to Seattle. And I am getting a lot of really positive feedback from people talking about how the film is nuanced and how I'm an American Israeli. I'm also Jewish. So of course I am biased to some point, but I would say that I tried my best to cover the topic from the side of not only pro-Palestinians, but also from people in the middle. You know, there are the pro-Palestinians, there are the pro-Israelis, but there's so many people without skin in the game that feel obliged to do something. And in addition, you know, the film also talks about doxing, which is something that we saw unfolding specifically with the people that ripped down the posters. What happened to people that were filmed while they're tearing down a poster and then identified online, doxed, and got fired from their jobs. So that's also something that the film covers. So in my film, I interview 10 New Yorkers, and some of them are activists, artists, and some of them are hostage family members. But I also brought into the film interviews of pro-Palestinians, and again, people in the middle that ripped down the posters and got caught.
Yeah, I remember seeing images of people ripping down posters and, you know, identify, and then on social media, you'd say, identify this person. And I take it that in fact happened and people were doxed.
Correct. I would say dozens and dozens of people got doxed, and I would say a percentage of that, these are people that were actually fired from their jobs.
Okay. In the studio, we have Park City local Harry Cantor. Harry, have you seen the film?
Oh, yes. I've seen it a number of times.
And how did you become involved with the film, and what inspired you to try to help bring it here to Park City?
Well, let me just start out by saying that I'm a native New Yorker, born and raised in New York, although my residency now is in Park City, Utah. And my wife and I are very much activists in Israel and pro-Israel causes, and we see a lot of evil and difficulty on both sides. And this film represented an opportunity for us to bring the discussion right here to Park City. My wife represents a museum in Israel, the Mishkan, and we were introduced to the artists, Dede and Nitzan, at this event. We had the pleasure of being at their studio, and we're so impressed by their actions, and then subsequently met Nim, and just thought that this film had a big impact, a big message, in a time that we really need some kind of unity.
And Harry, we'll do the logistics again at the end, but where will the film be screened, and how do you get to see it?
Well, the film will be screened August 11th. For security purposes, you have to register before you get the actual location, but you can go to the website, shalomutah.ticketspice.com, and you can register to see the film August 11th.
And will the director be here to talk about it?
The director will be here. There'll be a panel discussion, and there'll also be a reception prior to if you'd like to engage in it.
So one of the things that is interesting about this film and about this entire issue is, what do you think that the film and the issue tells us about the relationship between Israel and American Jews? Because you've seen, you know, increasing numbers of, you know, people expressing concerns about that. Nim, what's your take on that? What does it tell us?
So my main issue is that I say it in every screening and every time I get to talk to someone, we have to remember that people are not their government. And, you know, the majority of Israelis want the hostages out and end to the war at all costs. So that's number one. Israelis are not Netanyahu, and Gazans are not Hamas. We have to remember that we have to stop dehumanizing the other. And I think that's something very unfortunate that we see all over the world. I think that at the end of the day, we have different narratives. And the first thing we need to do is to talk to one another and understand each other's narratives. It doesn't mean that we have to agree, but we have to understand each other's narratives in order to come to some sort of coexistence. I also want to say that, you know, I am Israeli, and I do see what is happening around the world towards Israel and towards our government. But I would also say that, you know, there is a very huge uprise in anti-Semitism. And that is something very, very concerning. And I always, you know, to try and talk to people that are, you know, I want to give them the exercise of zooming out, and I'm asking them, would you treat or would you look at a person from China or Russia or Iran the same way you look at Israelis that live in the United States or Jews? So I feel like it's a very, very worrying time for me as a Jew and an Israeli that wants this nightmare that started on October 7, 2023 to end.
And what are some of the reactions you had to the film? Are there published reviews? And what are some of the reactions you get at the various screenings?
So I've had people, so we've screened the film not only in film festivals, we've screened it at a lot of universities, from Harvard to NYU. We screened it twice at Columbia, we screened it at Stanford. We had people that were in encampments, and they thanked us for the film, and they agreed with a lot of the messages in the film. We had a lot of engaging conversations in Berkeley with people that are Trump supporters and Kamala supporters. This was, of course, before the election. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at one minute, I kind of like took a step back, and it was an amazing conversation between the audiences, because I think what the film does is mostly ask questions. I don't give easy answers, and I don't give answers at all. I'm asking questions, and I'm asking people to zoom out from their narrative and look at the other side.
I suspect you don't give easy answers because there aren't any. And one of the things that I think would be really interesting is hearing from some of the people who tore down the posters as to why, what they felt the posters represented and why they felt compelled to tear them down.
So I think that, again, the level of dehumanization yeah. of, I have a, in the beginning of the film, I have someone that wanted to rip a poster of a five-year-old that was kidnapped with her mother. And when this person was asked, why are you ripping down this poster, the reaper said, that's a five-year-old, but she's actually a white colonizer. So again, the level of dehumanization is very, very troubling.
Okay, once again, the logistics, Harry, how do I get to go to see this? How do listeners get to go to the movie? Yeah. They have to sign up on, what's the website?
The website is shalomutah.ticketspice.com, and you can get the information there, and you can register for the film.
Okay, we've been talking to Nim Shapira and Harry Kantor about the film Torn. It's a new documentary about the Israel-Palestine conflict after October 7th. It will be screened on Monday, August 11th, and we just told you how to get tickets. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to KPCW in Park City, 91.7 and 81.1 FM in Summit, and 91.9 in Wasatch County. Thanks for joining us through this somewhat turbulent hour as we have struggled with a power failure. The community campfire will be coming up next. They're going to meet some people who aren't just feeding the hungry. They're reducing food waste by giving it a second chance.